Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it?
1999.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Iskov, and with me today is Hilary Busis, senior editor at Vanity Fair. She's here to talk to us about episode 213, The Games People Play. But before we get into this episode, I want to rewind, go back to 1999 for a second. Did you watch this show in 99? Did it come into your life later? How did it come into your life? And what is it that still speaks to you about the show?
So in 1999, that was the year that I turned 11, which...
You weren't watching the show at 11.
I was not watching the show. I was reading a lot of Judy Blume, which in retrospect, I think was preparing me to 100%. Eventually. Yeah. Like, I mean, that was, I think, probably the year that I like kind of transitioned from like spending every afternoon looking for Narnia into checking out Forever from the library and reading the dirty parts out loud to my friends at recess. A bit of a Samantha.
I was going to say, that's amazing. That's amazing.
But yeah, so wasn't aware of the show in 99 itself, except I guess in the way that anybody was, if I saw it on magazine covers or whatever. Sure. But yeah, definitely by high school, I was watching it with my friends. This is going to, I can't say that it's going to date me. I already told you that I was born in the year 1988, so we would rent the Sex and the City DVDs from Blockbuster. Mm-hmm. So that was how we first got exposed to the show. And then, I remember very distinctly spending like my entire spring break sophomore year, just binging it. Because at that point we had on demand on our cable, which was a very big deal at the time.
That's a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. So watched the entire series then. I think it had just, it must've just ended because I think 04 was the finale.
04 is when it ended. Yeah.
Yeah. So I caught up with the entire thing like right then. And I think that I came to it in the way that a lot of millennial women came to it, in that I watched it and it was aspirational, and I took exactly the wrong thing away from it, I guess. I was like, oh my God, they're so cool. They're in their 30s. They live alone and they go out and they drink drinks that are pink and like, oh my God, one day maybe that could be me. I went to Columbia primarily because I spent high school wanting to live in New York, and that was because of a combination of Sex and the City and Rent.
Oh, Jesus.
Which is sort of like
quite the mixture. Yeah.
Yeah. The two worst examples that you can have set for what it's going to be like when you move to New York.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Which felt very far away from New York City.
Sure.
Um, Pittsburgh is a weird kind of city in that when you live there, you kind of can convince yourself that you live on the East Coast. Sure. But everywhere else will consider you Midwestern. But like when I was there, I was like, oh, you know, Philadelphia is on the East Coast and we're in the same state. So given the transitive property.
Yeah, that makes sense. That tracks. Yeah.
Because as we know, Philadelphia is very sophisticated as well.
So do you feel like this, so you're 11 when it comes out, but you don't watch it for a few years after that, obviously.
No, and not until I'm like 15, 16.
15, 16. Do you feel like it affected the way that you, I mean, obviously we've had a lot of female guests on here for this mini series. Not just because the show is, let's be real, aimed primarily at women for the most part, but also just because I want to sort of...
How dare you?
I'm sorry. I mean, listen, I own all the box sets, so I'm fine with it, but I'm just, there's a part of me that just feels like there's a spectrum of ways that women sort of internalize this show. And I'm curious as to sort of what a 15, 16 year old Hillary felt like the takeaways were about the relationships between men and women.
Again, definitely all the wrong things. Like I was of the age and of the temperament to see Carrie and Big's relationship and think like, oh, this is so romantic. Like she's pining for him and like he's pushing her away, but really secretly he wants to be with her, which is not, I think, actually what that's what Carrie thinks, but it's not, I think, actually what's happening. Yeah. Like if he's just not that into you had happened way earlier in the show, then Carrie maybe could have like gone on with her life and done different, exactly. Like, made different choices. Yeah. But so of course, like when I was watching this and like at the time I have like a crush on like an unattainable boy. And so like, I feel like I definitely, it's the dynamic that you see play out in so many romantic comedies and even other types of entertainment, especially around this time. So it's not like Sex and the City is fully to blame at all for like propagating this idea that like an unattainable, like withdrawn, emotionally frigid man is like a prize to be won, and like if you can change him and fix him, then like that's the greatest love of all. But that's totally what I took away from it, which in retrospect, like absolutely I should have just been looking at like Steve and Miranda, and I feel like they've got the only healthy relationship on the show, and she's still really mean to him a lot of the time. So now that I say that,
I think Charlotte and Harry have a good relationship by the
end.
But
she's also really mean to him for a lot of time.
But she is pretty shitty to him because she's superficial and feels
and
as though,
she puts up with so much. And she gets mad at him for having a Harry back in the Hamptons. And it's like, this is just what he looks like.
And bald and sweating and all these things. Like, yeah,
I mean, the tea bags are gross, but I'll give her that.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that, I mean, the Carrie Big relationship is complicated because it feels like, you know, being a TV writer, there's the push and pull of it, you know what I mean, which is that you need to kind of
it's not an interesting story,
right? And if they are endgame, which I guess they decided sometime in the early, probably season one of the show, you have to constantly put wedges in between them and find, you know, hurdles in order for difficulties and what have you. So I don't want to hold that entirely against Big's character, because I don't necessarily think it's entirely his fault. Some of it is just the nature of writing television. But yeah. I do think that my issues watching it this time with the relationship have more to do with Carrie and why she keeps going back for more sort of emotional abuse from him is maybe the more damning thing, I would say. It's this, this, as you were speaking of, this sort of this unattainability of his character, but this relentlessness on her part to somehow find a way to make it work that feels pretty sad.
I mean, completely. Yeah, which is why, by the way, she should have stayed in therapy.
We're going to get to that because I want to talk about that. I want to talk about Carrie and mental health in a second. But I do feel like there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, she has like her own section in the DSM.
She should. I mean, truly. I there's a part of me too that feels like, and I talked about this on another episode. I can't remember which one, but just this idea that like your lead character of a television show, unfortunately, has to kind of be a Swiss Army knife in a lot of ways, and they're protected in ways that other characters aren't, and they're a little bit more of sort of the voice of the audience sometimes. So
protected, that like nothing really bad can happen to them. Or,
correct. Yeah. They can't. I mean, I'll say this, and I spoke with Emily Nussbaum about this in the first episode about the anti-hero that is Carrie Bradshaw, and sort of the glass ceiling that the character broke in terms of being messy and broken and being able to do fucked up things, which is a very much an HBO thing, but also just sort of changed the dynamics of what a female protagonist in a romantic comedy scenario can and can't do. But I still think that Carrie is kind of protected in the fact that they don't want her to do. I mean, I think her cheating on Aiden is probably the biggest, most damning thing that she does, I think, in terms of like from a soapy character perspective. And I think that they were, I mean, from interviews and what have you, Michael Patrick King was worried about that. Like, was the audience going to go on this ride with her now, knowing that she had done this, continue to do this terrible thing?
And I mean, they wouldn't have if she and Big weren't Endgame, and like people watching the show didn't think that.
Correct. Even if, yes. So it's just, it's interesting to see.
I'm also an on the record Aiden hater. So I just feel like I should get that out right now. I think that cheating on him was bad, but also that he sucks. And that is something we should acknowledge both things at the same time.
Interesting. Can you unpack that for me? What is it about him please. What is it about Aiden that you don't, what is it about that relationship that you didn't like?
Well, so I feel like there is a way in which the Carrie Aiden dynamic kind of replicates the Carrie Big dynamic, except that Aiden is Carrie and Carrie is Big. And he,
that's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that he's more in love with the idea of her than he is of her herself. And he keeps on trying to change her. He tries to turn her into somebody who enjoys going to the country and somebody who enjoys eating a bucket of chicken in front of the TV and somebody who doesn't smoke and like all of these things that are pretty intrinsic to her character. And like, you can say that these things are good or bad, that she, you know, is always going out, that she's always out and that she has these sometimes superficial interests and all these things, but like, that is who she is. And like, if he just wants to be like dating a quirky writer, but one who has all the same interests as him, then I don't think that Carrie is the right person for him. And I think that she really like tries to contort herself into his idea of her. And that's why they don't work. Like, because I just think that from the beginning, they're looking for like, he doesn't really love the actual Carrie, who is messy and shitty a lot of the time and selfish. And she really wants to like be with him because he's this like stable, relatively normal. I don't know. He also has a very annoying voice, but that's kind of petty of me.
How do you really feel about John Corbett?
I wish John Corbett the best. My Big Fat Greek Wedding, great romantic comedy.
Sure. Like, that's great. Yeah.
But Aiden as a character, I think that I don't think he's an unrealistic kind of person, but I do think that he is shitty in his own way and that gets kind of papered over because obviously Big is so much worse.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree in the sense, I really love that take of he is the sort of the Carrie to her Carrie Big. Like, I think that's a really interesting theory. I would also say too, that I think that season 3 Aiden is a lot less interesting than season 4 Aiden.
When he's like punishing her.
Yeah. He's punishing her and he's grappling with some shit that I think is interesting. Like he's actually sort of trying to imagine a future with this person, right? Like he's really trying to sort of bend himself to a certain degree. And she's like, they're trying to actually make it work in season 4. In season 3, he feels like a foil. He feels like a thing that's just sort of there.
And he's a nice guy. Really rebound. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree with you that he's not as interesting as season 3. I mean, and I don't disagree. They certainly shouldn't have ended up together, but I do think that Aiden's a better person than Big.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great leap to be a better person than Big.
Sure. Who is your favorite paramours? Who is your favorite of Carrie's paramours?
My favorite of her boyfriends, I mean, I really wish that she could have made it work with, I think, the second time she dates Justin Theroux.
Sure.
Because his family is really cool, and I feel like that would have been like good for her to have like Valerie Harper as that great role model. I don't care about him himself. I feel like the only decent guy she ever meets is, I forget, it's in the episode where the theme is freaks, and she just meets a normal
Tweety Bird tattoo.
Yeah. She meets like a normal guy outside by a fountain in Central Park or something, and he seems great. And then she scares him off and realizes that she's the freak. I feel like he's like the only decent person that Carrie ever actually dates.
What does that not speak volumes that the nicest guy that she met is the one she freaked out in front of the most and acted the most psychotic?
Fair enough, somebody that we know for 3 minutes of screen time. So yes. I don't know. He could have bodies buried somewhere.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I'll say this. I think that she, you know, I was watching, there were, you know, how obviously it's on E! It feels like perpetually they're constantly airing the butchered version of the show. And for whatever reason, if I stumble upon it, I still watch it, which goes to show something. I'm not sure what.
It's the most easy, like cardigan. You slide it on, you just like watch it. And even if it's the bad censored version, I can't help watching Sex and the City all the time too.
So I watched a couple episodes from the top of season 6, which is the burger stuff. And I think that like, there's a version of Berger that, first of all, is just dialed way down. Like, there's just too much of, like, him trying to be, like, witty writer guy, which is just too much. But I really like Ron Livingston, and they do have a nice chemistry together. And I think that there's a version where I could have seen her possibly ending up with a Berger-type person.
Yeah, no, totally. I think that he would make a lot of sense for her if he could get over whatever his weird insecurities are.
Sure. Sure.
But that does seem like a big ask also.
100%. 100%. So this particular episode, which is episode 213, Games People Play, I'm going to give a brief synopsis. Carrie starts going to therapy after obsessing over Big for too long. Offended by the diagnosis of dating men who are wrong for her, she dates cute fellow patient Seth, played by John Bon Jovi of all people, a guy who loses interest in women after sleeping with them. Miranda plays peekaboo with her cute across the air shaft neighbor, and Samantha dates a sports fanatic whose mood depends on who won the game that night. Games People Play aired on August 29th, 1999. It was written by Jenny Bix, directed by Michael Spiller. It ended up at number 86 of 96 episodes on Vulture's list, saying, ouch, important-ish takeaway this time, Carrie goes to therapy to deal with her big issues, which, good idea. This is also the episode where she dates John Bon Jovi, a fellow patient who, not good idea. Moving on. That's basically their review. So I kind of want to break it down by storylines, because it feels, even though Charlotte kind of doesn't really have a storyline in this episode, she supposedly had one, but I guess it got cut. Her storyline involved her joining a bridge club to meet a nice man or something. I don't know.
A nice 90-year-old man?
I was going to say, I don't really get it, but that happened apparently. So I want to sort of come at it sort of, I want to leave the Carrie storyline for last because it feels like the biggest thing to unpack. But the general idea is the episode opens with Carrie talking to her friends, obviously. They're tired of her talking about Big so much, claiming that she's over him when all she does is talk about him. Samantha has a great line where she says, "We're as fucked up as you are. It's like the blind leading the blind," which is, I mean, kind of perfect and great. They tell her she needs to go to a therapist. So Miranda, I want to start with this Miranda storyline because I have issues with this Miranda storyline.
Poor Miranda. That's my takeaway.
But it's, yes, it's poor Miranda, but it's also like, this is strange and in a way that, so essentially Miranda sees a guy across the hall, across the building across from hers. Yeah. Air shaft. who starts essentially like stripping for her and kind of like flirting with her. Would you ever in a million years, like, would any human being ever partake in a situation like this?
I mean, the twist in the story, of course, winds up being that, why would I say spoiler?
There's no dump. We're talking about the storyline. Go for it. Yeah.
Is that he has actually been cruising, apparently, the guy who lives right underneath Miranda, which also the fact that he recognizes her means that he has been looking at her, like showing her tits to him, which is so humiliating. Like,
it's, so, I mean, the whole thing is humiliating for Miranda.
So, and like, I gotta say, they really pile the humiliating stuff onto Miranda. Like, she eats cake out of the garbage at some point.
This is true. She does eat cake out of the garbage. She eats an entire cookie that says, "I love you."
Oh my God. So the show is fresh in my mind because I watched it again when I was on maternity leave, which was last year. So is helpful for, like, because when I was watching again, I was just cataloging all of the absolutely humiliating things that happened to Miranda, because it just gets piles on her. There's a whole episode where her B plot is that she's in love with her Tebow.
The other thing about this storyline that I find a little upsetting, and I don't know if it's subtext, and I like to think that it's not, but there's a little bit of, like, this is why Miranda goes to therapy. Like, this idea that, like,
oh, Miranda, she makes an emergency appointment at the end.
Right, which she does. And this idea of, and they kind of tack on this in the VO, this imaginary friend thing, which is new, which comes out of kind of nowhere.
I love how Sex and the City does that, how they'll be like, oh, you know, my oldest friend, here's Charlotte's brother. We'll never see him. He's not going to come to either of her weddings.
Yeah, no, they do this a fair amount. I mean, and part of it is that they sometimes lean into the procedural component of the show, and sometimes they want to be a serialized show. They want to be serialized when it comes to sort of the soap and the character stuff, which is fair, which is why you would think that Charlotte's brother would feature more prominently down the road, but I guess...
Or at least just show up one more time.
Mm-hmm. You would think. But the Miranda storyline, essentially, she starts flirting with this guy across the air shaft. She starts flashing him at a certain point. She then goes to a supermarket at the end where she sees him. And in classic Miranda form, she, like, kind of saddles up to him at, like, the frozen food section and, like, tries to be, like, subtle about it. And there's, like, but, like, come on, dude. Like, why aren't you recognizing me? He's an asshole to her, though. Like, he is a bitchy asshole to her for kind of no reason.
Yeah, that's true. He doesn't have to be a bitch.
He could just sort of be like, ugh, awkward. Yeah, no, I'm actually not flirting with you. I'm flirting with the guy below you. Sorry. Like, be funny about it. But he's shitty about it. And I don't quite get why that
is. I gotta also say that, I mean, getting on Sex and the City, like, for not being entirely logical is a little silly, but that somehow every single time he's flirting with the guy across the street, Miranda also happens to be looking out her window and happens to be, like, doing things that he appears to react to, that's a little far-fetched. Let's just say that.
It's a little far-fetched, and also if he was actually looking at somebody else, eye lines would come into play too. Like, you would start to, yeah.
So at some point, she's perceptive. She's a lawyer. Like,
yeah, she's a smart person. Yeah. It's a sad storyline for Miranda this week. I will say that I agree with you. They do tend to pile it on with her. It's to Cynthia Nixon's unbelievable talents and abilities to sort of imbue her, not just with humanity and make her into a real person, but also not to make her seem like a sad sack either. Like, she doesn't ever feel that way. But yeah, this season, it just feels like she really, I mean, she meets Steve, so I guess that's all fine and good. But the other storyline is Samantha, they go to, so this is a weird thing, they go to a sports bar?
I feel like this is why the episode is ranked so poorly, because wait, I wrote down,
please, yeah.
I wrote down something that Carrie says when they find the sports bar. Sports night, every female's fantasy, a room full of attractive heterosexual men all looking to be distracted during commercial breaks. Are you kidding me? Speaking for all heterosexual women, I cannot tell you a single thing I would rather do less than go to a sports bar on game night. Are you kidding me?
I know.
That is the seventh circle of hell. Like, I would not ever voluntarily do that.
The show definitely twists itself into pretzels sometimes to hit its themes, which I think you obviously can attest to.
You know, they sell pretzels at sports games, so you're doing it too.
It's a part of it, I think, is they only have 22, 24 minutes. There's not a lot of real estate. I mean, even in this episode, Charlotte doesn't get a storyline. So, you know, they definitely sort of, you know, it is what it is. But I do feel like them going to a sports bar, I would rather have them stumble into a sports bar.
They go there on purpose, yeah.
I know. It's insane. I know. It's crazy. But they go to this sports bar. Samantha immediately lasers in on some guy who, like, looks at her for half a second, goes to the bar, starts talking to this guy. His name is Don, and he imports Mexican handbags, which is a very specific thing that I'm just like, sure.
Yeah, is this one of those
I never
things,
touch on again.
Yeah, is this one of those things that we look at and are like, come on, but then somebody in the Sex and City writers room would be like, well, actually, my boyfriend Ron
Well, that, so I have had the, I've had the pleasure of interviewing a couple writers so far on the show. Amy B. Harris came on, and Cindy Chupac as well. Hopefully there will be more to come. But what I think is interesting is they talked about that, like how The Room was very much a sort of cathartic safe space where it was all about, the, most of them were either single or some of them were single, talking about, it seems like all of this stuff for the most part starts from a place of reality. And then obviously they turn it into a comedy, but, she meets this guy, Don. He's over the, he's very into sports. Samantha finds that a turn on. I find it hard to believe that Samantha has never crossed paths with a man who's into sports before.
Just knowing everything we know about Samantha, this is completely wrong. Why would she ever be interested in this dude? I feel like, especially in the early seasons too, the show has this weird habit of the guys just not being very attractive, that like, mm-hmm. these are four gorgeous women who like really make an effort. And they're always like with these like very regular looking, like chino wearing, like this is what the casting people think like Sarah Jessica Parker and Kim Cattrall like could get. I don't know. I find that also like an affront.
It's true. I mean, it feels like the one-off guys tend to fall into that category of just
the,
sort of like,
the real boyfriends are more charismatic and generally better looking.
And quite frankly, better actors. So there's that too. But she, it's so the theme of this episode is the games people play when it comes to dating and how it affects their mental health. So there's a literal component to Samantha's storyline, which is that this guy is obviously obsessed with sports. He can only or only chooses to have sex with her when his team is winning. By the way,
and also like Samantha doesn't have guys in reserve that she can just go have sex with at like
she's, of course.
Why would she ever only have like, it's insane. Maybe if Charlotte had dated this guy, it would make sense, but it doesn't make any sense for Samantha.
There's also, I mean, you live in New York, correct? You're a
now,
New Yorker.
Yes.
Yeah, the Knicks suck, so you're not having sex a lot.
Well, I don't know what they were like in 1999. I don't know what they were like in 1999.
It's possible they were better then. But yeah, so it's sort of this, it's a very broad storyline. Ultimately, it ends where the Knicks win the final game. She thinks it's going to be great. And then he's like, now he's into the Mets because it's the Mets to whatever. And she's like, fuck it, I'm out of here. So it's a very sort of broadly comedic Samantha storyline, which is fine. In an episode where Carrie's storyline is a lot meatier, and her storyline essentially is about the fact that everyone says she needs to go to therapy. We need to talk about Carrie and Charlotte's perspectives on mental health and psychiatry and therapy.
Yeah, I think that that's a thing that feels very of its era.
Is so that's ultimately my question, right? Like, I like to believe that if and when the revival lands on our HBO Max, we'll talk about that at the end. I do kind of feel like I hope that there's a progression in terms of the way that they perceive things, because the show is not as, it's progressive for 99, I guess. Now it's always sort of like the first one through the wall gets bloody, right? So this idea that like they were the first ones to talk about a lot of things, and did they go as far as they needed to? Probably not. But I respect that they took the swings. It's why I'm surprised it's so regressive when it comes to mental health.
Yeah, no, totally. And especially, I mean, The Sopranos is on around the same time, and it has a much more like nuanced view of mental health and therapy.
And that's Tony Soprano of all people.
Yeah, no, they're airing at the same time. Which is weird when you think of it, but yeah, no, Sex and the City has a very skeptical view of therapy. Kind of, it makes it seem like mental health problems are kind of made up. That if you can just buckle down, you can solve these things on your own. Like Miranda and Stanford are both portrayed as being kind of silly for seeing therapists, like as though it's this kind of self-centered thing that they're doing. And like Stanford points out Carrie's therapist, like sees Gwyneth Paltrow also. So it's like a status thing. Yeah. It's very, from a 2021 lens, it's very, strange.
I also love that the Gwyneth Paltrow line is so blatantly ADR that I'm just like, was it somebody else when they shot it? And they were like, we can't say that name anymore. I don't know. But
that's another thing that Sex and the City is out in the front of, is making fun of Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, this is true. Way ahead of the game on that. Yeah, I mean, I think that it doesn't surprise me from Charlotte. And that's not to say that Charlotte is a caricature, but it, based on her, I mean, literally she has a line where she says, my parents don't believe in therapy, we just play a lot of tennis.
Yeah, so, which is what I would think of a WASP yes. from Connecticut. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
absolutely. Carrie, it surprises me that she thinks therapy is bullshit. And I don't know if that's reactionary in terms of the whole, and, you know, dare I say his name, the whole neurotic Woody Allen kind of therapy, New Yorker kind of persona that they were trying to sort of shun a little bit, or to show that she was different in that perspective. I don't necessarily think that Carrie seems like a person that would be so short-sighted on that particular thing. It surprised me.
She was generally open-minded and, yeah. you know, she'll kiss Alanis Morissette at a party. Like, why not? So it is right? kind yeah. of... Yeah, strange that she doesn't have more of like a wait and see kind of attitude about it. I mean, and again, like, it really could have helped her if she had just given it a try.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's one of those things too, where at first I was like, okay, I get it. Carrie's going to be against therapy at the beginning of the episode, but she's going to see the error of her ways by the end of the episode, and it'll end with like, and I'm going to see a new therapist, and we just won't ever see her do therapy again. But instead, she learns fucking nothing from any of the episode about therapy, about herself, about really anything, and then just says, I'm not going to this therapist again because I can't bump into Seth in the waiting room. Credits.
It's too bad that she's the only therapist in New York, that she doesn't have like a different appointment time that Carrie could possibly try to make.
It's to me, it's also, and I hate to say this because I mean, whatever, but like, it feels like you're leaving money on the table too from a writing perspective. If you've got like, leave that door open for future therapy sessions if you decide that you want to go there or whatever. And again, maybe, you know, listen, Sopranos premieres literally in 99, so it's possible that they're just like, we're not going back to the therapy well.
Yeah, maybe they just thought that it would seem too similar, which I would understand. They're on the same network. They're both very buzzy.
Sure. And it's downright shocking to me that Carrie doesn't, by the end of the episode, see the possible positive effects of therapy.
What she says at the beginning of the episode that like Carrie and Samantha and Miranda all dismiss, she's like, who needs therapy? I've got you guys. But like, I don't know. It shouldn't be her friend's responsibility to get her to be well-adjusted.
Nope. It's also, so this, so essentially Carrie goes to this doctor, Dr. G, who has an office that looks like an alien spaceship. It's all white.
There's like weird toys on the shelves. Like, yes. I don't know if that's like a Rorschach thing.
It's very strange. Carrie also says something when she's talking with her friends earlier. She says, therapy is so self-indulgent. And I want to be like, Carrie, you are
Most
self-indulgent person ever. But that's whatever. So she goes to the Dr. G, and she has a session, which I guess she doesn't find particularly helpful, where the doctor tells her that she chooses the wrong men. Spoiler, the doctor's right.
And then 4 more seasons continue to prove her right.
But they go for a walk, the 4 of them, and they start talking about the idea of games. Charlotte thinks the games are empowering. This surprises me not a one bit. But they talk about this idea of the games that men and women play when they're dating and when they're sort of circling other people. I think there's some legitimacy to the idea that people play games when they're dating. There's the, you know, who has the better poker face, who can pretend like they like the other person less.
Yeah, like, this is the era of the rules, I think. Yeah, like what's that out around now?
It's all that sort of bullshit. The shot of Carrie reaching to the top of her bookshelf to a stack of board games felt a little on the nose.
Just slightly. Oh, and then they play Twister.
And then they play Twister later.
Fairly ridiculous.
It also is the return, weirdly, of the Talking Heads shit, which I hate, of the man on the street stuff, which I don't...
They killed that in season two at some point.
Yes, it doesn't show up in season three. I thought it was done by this point. I mean, we're at episode 13. We've gone at least 5 or 6 episodes without it, so I was surprised that it popped back up again, especially when you look at, like, you didn't give Charlotte a storyline, but you decided to give, like, a minute and a half to this bullshit. I don't really get it. The other thing that this episode reminded me of is the David Duchovny episode in season 6, where she gets back together with her high school boyfriend, and he has put himself in a mental institution, essentially.
I'm sure there's some way that that's Carrie's fault.
100%. That I don't doubt. But it's just interesting how this show treats mental health.
It's very jokey.
Yeah. You know, and someone who is in therapy myself, I do feel like, I don't know. I get that it's a joke. I get that sometimes you can make fun of it. Like, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with finding the humor in it. That's all fine and good. But when people don't see, like David Duchovny's character does feel like he believes that this is helping him. So I don't mean to suggest that they're deriding.
So maybe they had evolved their views at some point.
That's kind of what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
And it's understandable why Carrie decides, you know, to not keep dating a guy who's decided to put himself into a mental facility. That feels like the right play. So
of course, if Big had put himself into a mental hospital, she would like take out her candy striper uniform, get right in there.
Do whatever. Yeah, exactly. Here's my question for you. Seth, as a character, doesn't really have one.
No.
He shows up in the waiting room, asks her out. I would never ask out a person that was in the waiting room at my therapist's office. It feels, first of all, inappropriate. But it also just feels like you're asking for it. Like you're
I mean, I think it kind of goes to the show's, or at least this episode's, like, view of, like, it doesn't seem like an accident that the therapy plot is in an episode that's themed around games. Like, it doesn't take it seriously, and so I think it's totally appropriate, like, in the world of the show then, for this to happen, because the show doesn't believe in the value, or I mean, at least at this point, doesn't seem to really believe in the value of talking out your problems with a professional.
I mean, I'm surprised that it didn't just go one step further and it's a male psychiatrist and she just starts dating her shrink. Like, I mean,
that does seem like something the show would do.
Right. I mean, but the thing that was sort of weird about the Seth of it all is I get that Jon Bon Jovi's an attractive guy. So I guess ultimately it was more of just a kind of stunt casting, fun, cute thing to do. And I think when it ends up being Jon Bon Jovi, on some level, he's imbued with more interest just because he's Jon Bon Jovi.
I think so, yeah. If it had just been like rando Don Mexican handbag dealer guy, then you would understand less why Carrie was like going against whatever judgment she has to date a guy who sees the same therapist as her.
So she goes on a date with him. They go to dinner. Then they go out again. He comes over to her place. They play Twister together, which, I mean, the Twister scene is cute. I mean, I'm not made of stone.
She's wearing the most ridiculous outfit. I feel like I have to point out, she has these like bright yellow hot pants, this like basically bra top. It's just a halter, and it's a cropped halter, Like, yeah. I mean, she looks amazing. And these enormous heels is like very, it feels very carry, but it also is very impractical to be playing Twister in.
100%. She, I mean, it does feel like, and like everything on Sex and the City, that it's a tee up to a joke, which is that later she's like, yellow pants came off because of the Twister.
They can't resist.
They can't resist. It's a cute scene. They have sex. Carrie asks Seth, and this is, I have to say, every now and then the show really kind of lands a punch. And them lying in bed together post-coital, she asks him why he's in therapy. He says, I'm really fucked up about women. After I sleep with them, I completely lose interest. It's great. I mean, it's a great, it's a great
punchline. Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a solid, like...
You can see it coming, but I think it does still land. You're right.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's one of those things where every now and then the show does those sort of late night pillow talky kind of the dark of night, sort of dark soul of the night kind of thing. And Carrie, and then him asking her why she's in therapy, and she turns over and says, I picked the wrong man. It's a great, like, sobering.
You can hear kind like a womp womp.
Yeah, it's but it's also like, for a brief instant, you think Carrie learned something,
and then it is kind of, it does feel like I would wonder why they never sent her back to therapy. I don't know. Maybe they just thought that it would not be interesting to like have her explain things that the show would rather show. But
I would even go as far as to say, have her date a therapist. He doesn't need to be her therapist. I mean, just to show that like she's capable of a little bit of introspection. She's it's so interesting because like she's obviously the most introspective character on television. She spends literally VO talking about everything that's going on in her life. But she can't see the forest for the trees, which I guess is part of the irony of the show, I guess. But
yeah, it's weird. It doesn't feel like she changes that much over the course of it, which everybody else does. But Carrie just kind of keeps on being selfish, like keeps on being like, you know, a good time gal, and like winds up getting everything that she wants. Whereas like Miranda and Charlotte and Samantha each, I think, have a lot more growth. You know, Samantha learns to allow herself to be vulnerable, and Miranda, like, also a similar thing, like, kind of lets her walls down, and Charlotte becomes less superficial. But, like, Carrie just keeps on being Carrie and then is rewarded for it. So I can understand, like, when I watched it in high school, I was like, oh, this ending, it's, you know, so perfect. They finally end up together. I'm so happy. But, like, yeah, it does feel like she gets kind of shortchanged, and I don't know if that's because, like, as the point of view character, they don't want her point of view to change too much or what, but yeah, she really doesn't grow or learn as much as everybody around her.
You know, it's funny, as you were saying that, I was thinking about one of my favorite episodes is Splat, which is in the last season.
Great episode.
It's a great episode, and you get a phenomenal fight between Carrie and Miranda at the end, where Carrie says, you're living in a fantasy. And then Carrie basically says, fuck you, and gets on a horse-drawn carriage in Central Park in the snow. And then basically proves that Miranda was wrong and that the fantasy is true and that she is living in a fantasy and it's all okay. Like, yeah. it's unfortunate that, to your point, that Carrie doesn't have a real come to Jesus moment. It's I guess the closest thing is going to Paris with the wrong man
and realizing how, you know, she doesn't have a life there. She doesn't know anybody who can speak the language. Like those up that like the lead up to like when Big rescues her is really great, because it is kind of like, yeah, you see the air come out of her. Like it's tough to watch, but like she has to miss that book club meeting with those like very nice French people. Like, it does feel like, yeah, she's gonna have like a, like you said, a come to Jesus, some kind of realization. But no, then Big arrives and he's on a white horse and it winds up, she goes back to her regular life and everything is just as she left it. Like an unsatisfying ending when you think about
it. She had to see a wine glass stain on her book to really see the error of her ways.
There's also a great scene where she's like sitting next to a dog in a cafe.
And she gives him like half the thing that she's eating. Yeah, it's, you know, it is interesting. I feel like, and I don't even really want to talk about the movies at all, but I do think that, because I do think that they don't move the ball down the field at all, really.
No, the movies are bad because they freeze everybody in amber and like are just wish fulfillment and like don't have any of the nuance of the show. I mean, that's commonly, you know, everybody who likes, I feel like if you really like the show, you can't like the movies.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, the movies have come up pretty regularly in these episodes, as you can imagine. And it does feel like there are some people where the movies just, they exist. And like when they're on TV, people will watch them. Like or at least the first one, it feels like it's widely known that the second one is
garbage. Yeah.
But it's very interesting how sort of, how the other characters in, I mean, I think that last run of, I think it's six episodes, which is sort of part two of season six, feels like a movie unto itself, right? If you just chopped off the credits and put those all together, it could feel like a movie. And it does a really great job of everyone feeling like they're growing except for Carrie. It's just, it is very interesting. So I have to ask, what are your thoughts on the impending revival that is coming our way someday? And probably, I assume, I mean, they're claiming that we're getting it by the end of this season. I will be shocked if we get it by the end of 2021. Yeah, but
they're starting to shoot in late spring, they said, right? So that's...
Yeah, the room started last week, if I'm not mistaken, or 2 weeks ago. So
I feel like Little Red Riding Hood. I feel excited and scared. I can't wait. I love Sex and the City. I can't wait to watch new episodes. Like this, I'm not a Gilmore Girls person, but I feel like this is probably how they felt about the Netflix revival. It's like, it's not going to be the same. It's going to be missing a very important person. Like the fact that Kim Cattrall's not in it at all is going to change the chemistry a lot. Like I have no idea how that's going to look like, because if it's just a show about Carrie, I feel like Sex and the City doesn't really work. Like the chemistry between the leads is so crucial. So I expect not to like it, but I still really want to watch it, if that makes sense. And I don't know.
I was talking to someone. I'm sorry, please.
Oh, I was going to say that I think it will kind of come down to how they deal with Samantha, that's going to be like very kind of symbolic or emblematic of the entire Enterprise. Like if they kill her versus like trying to replace her versus just like establishing in a storyline in the show that they're no longer friends with Samantha. And maybe the whole season is like explaining why that happened. Like that, I think that would be a really interesting way for it to go. But it would be kind of dark and sad. And I don't know if Sex and the City now, given the movies, which are the most recent Sex and the City product we have, I don't know if dark and interesting and complex is really what the people behind the show right now want the show to be. Like I think they're going to make it something more colorful and punny and lean into the fashion and the glamour and all of that, and if they do that, then I guess, you know, it's going to be like the movies, which we know how those turned out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm similar to you. I'll watch every episode. I'm excited to see what they do. I have barely any expectations for it. Like I think that it's, and I don't say that, I don't mean that to sound as shitty as maybe it does sound. I think that it's, to your point, I was talking to someone about this the other day, that if the show is about falling out from friends as you get older, and the idea that, you know, these women are, I think they're over 50 now, correct?
Or at least everybody, I think everybody is at this point,
Or at least in their late 40s. You change as a person, right? Friends fall out. Like it's how it goes. And
even if it's just they drifted apart, not necessarily that there was like a big fight.
Like that's interesting to me, to your point. Like if this is about, and again, that doesn't, you don't need to make the entire run about that. But if you do kind of say like up top, like we just had a falling out and you know, whatever, or they decide to, you know, throw her to, you know, Abu Dhabi or wherever the hell she decides to land. Like, I guess that's fine.
And like the first episode is they're at brunch and Charlotte's like, I can't believe Samantha went to the moon.
I mean, honestly, it feels like that's what it's going to end up being. I think we know that. And then they're just going to try to sort of, my feeling is they won't try to create another fourth person. I certainly hope that they don't try to do that. I'm sure there will be other people that will sort of fill that.
I guess they could have like Stanford step up or something. Maybe that would feel like less unnatural.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I keep thinking about, you mentioned the Gilmore Girls revival. I have not watched all of Gilmore Girls. I watched the first two seasons, I think, and then I watched the revival. So, I mean, whatever. But the X-Files is another one where it's like people were real excited for those revivals. They were, by and large, not great.
I don't know if there's really been a revival that hasn't been disappointing, like, primarily.
It does feel, and I wanted to posit this to you as well, because I talked about this a little bit on Twitter as I was watching the Sex and the City movies, trying to think of a show that has transitioned to the big screen successfully. There are arguments that the first X-Files movie was a successful transition to the screen, and then coming back to television, that's pretty crazy that they were able to actually do that. I can't really think of another one that's really done it particularly well. There are Serenity fans that would claim that the Firefly movie was a successful film from television. Do you think that it worked?
I guess if you're thinking about just TV shows that became movies, but not necessarily like the same cast, there are more options. But
right.
Yeah, that's different from what you're saying. So yeah,
it's tough. It's really tough. I think that as an audience member, you approach a movie and a television show very differently. A television show, they're your friends and you're literally in your TV room. Like you're checking in on them every week. A movie is this thing the size of a fucking building and these people don't seem like real people anymore, or just different anyway. I'm curious to see if this show can find the intimacy and the genuine character moments again when it comes back.
I think it's a good thing that it's going to be a limited series and not another movie. I think that, you know, in as much as there's a difference between movies and television anymore, which is less and less true, I do think that the TV format fits, like you were saying, Sex and the City better, and that it will have a better shot of working if it's a half hour show again.
I agree. So do you, as I've been asking all of my guests, do you have a favorite character on Sex and the City and why?
Well, you mentioned Splat, and Kristen Johnson's character, Lexi Featherton, is so great. I would watch, I mean, forget the Sex and the City limited series, like I would watch a prequel that's about like Lexi in the 80s, just like at Studio 54 or something. I feel like that would be so, or Tunnel, I don't know, what's like the club in the 80s? I'm thinking about American Psycho. But yeah, I feel like that would be so fun. probably the episode that is closest to my heart, I feel like this is everybody's favorite episode, is Hot Child in the City, where one of the subplots is that Samantha is doing Kat Dennings' bat mitzvah. And maybe because when I started watching the show, I was like around bat mitzvah age, like that really, really stuck with me. But I think that her character is also really fun. If we're talking about like favorite minor characters, she's like really at the top. There's this like one line from her that like runs in my head every so often, which is when like her and her friends, they're all 13 obviously, but they're like pretending that they're adults and they're like trying to act older, and like NSYNC is performing at the bat mitzvah or something, and one of her friends says that she thinks everybody at NSYNC is gay, which, you know, 1 out of 5 isn't bad, but then Kat Dennings says, who cares? I'd fuck him and his gay boyfriend. And just like the delivery.
She's amazing in that episode.
Well,
she's really
so good in that episode. Yeah, like
she really, really is.
I wish that there had been a show about her too. Just like the life of 13-year-old Samantha.
I mean, you should pitch a Lexi Featherstone prequel show, because I would – see this. So, okay. This leads to, I guess, a sub question, which is, what are your thoughts on the Carrie Diaries? Cause I actually really loved it, even if I felt like it's canon got a little bit wonky.
So the Carrie Diaries, I think I saw a couple of episodes of it. I did definitely read the Carrie Diaries book. There were at least a couple, and I think I read the first one. And it's like, I think it's like a, cute idea, like to have Muppet Babies Sex in the City. Even though it kind of threw out any of the continuity about Carrie's past that we knew according to the show, because yeah. I mean, according to the show, what, like her dad left her when she was a kid or something, but then yeah. on the Carrie Diary, she has a single dad. Am I getting that right?
That's correct. She also has a sister named Dorrit, and you think we would have met her sister.
Dorrit? Like,
correct.
Little Dorrit? Dorrit? Why would her name be Dorrit? Why would you, like, this is my daughter Carrie and my daughter Dorrit?
I think that you kind of summed it up perfectly when you said that it's an endearing idea of Muppet Babies Carrie.
Yeah.
I think that Sophia, is her name right? Sophia Robb, isn't that her name?
Anna Sophia Robb.
Anna Sophia Robb, yes. She's fantastic, even if she's never going to grow into looking like Sarah Jessica Parker. She's tremendous. I think that all the casting is great, and if you can kind of turn your brain off to the fact that it doesn't totally connect on a canon level or a canonical level, I just think that it was a really sweet show. I watched all two seasons of it. I think that it didn't really hit because I think it was, I guess my point is, if that show was on HBO Max right now, that thing would be running for 15 years.
Oh, I think believe that. Yeah.
It was a little too early in that whole kind of wave that was coming. And the actress they found to play young Samantha looked so frighteningly like a young Kim Cattrall.
Oh, I have to like look this up now.
You should look her up. It's like,
did Charlotte and Miranda show up, or did they not have time for that?
They didn't show up, but Samantha shows up in season two, and the actress is just, it's unreal. It's like uncanny. But yeah, it was a really sweet show, and I quite liked it, and I wish that it had gone on for a little bit longer. But it begs the question a little bit if this revival is going to find ways to create spinoffs and things like that, and whether the Carrie universe is going to grow. it's hard to say.
The MCU, the Miranda Carey universe.
The Miranda Carey universe. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this episode with me, Hillary. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. Podcast like it's
1999. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.